Glad that you could join us for the Bible study. So tonight, as I said, we're going to talk about, we've been talking about wisdom and how essential that is for us to acquire and develop. But there's an wisdom is the right way to go, the positive, but there's also a negative side of things which God designates as foolishness or the fool. And so we're going to take a look at that subject, and there are quite a few verses that you could cover in regard to folly and foolishness and fool. And so we won't get through all of them, but we'll look at a number of verses that I think hopefully we will take something away from the study that will be a benefit to us. In the notes that I put together as I looked at the topic, you've got three basic Hebrew words that are translated as fool, and they mean a little bit different. I have a little bit different meanings. One of the words is used 19 times in Proverbs, and others 49 times in Proverbs. And the one that we're most familiar with is the word Nabal, which is used just 3 times in Proverbs, but it is found throughout the Hebrew scriptures, and you find it in reference to a man that was married to Abigail, and he epitomized being a fool because of the run-in that he had with David. But Nabal is interesting, and you find it mentioned that would be the most prominent one we have, even though it may not be used most often. But if there's a fundamental quality of a person who is a fool, it's found in Psalm chapter 14, verse 1. Psalm chapter 14, verse 1. And really, this is the definition of a fool. And it is something that we have to consider and always keep in mind. And we're going to look at this verse and just see what it says and the verses that follow down to verse 5. And then we're going to look at whether this has any application to Christians. And if it applies to Christians, then how does it apply? So anyway, let's go to Psalm 14 and begin in verse 1. So we have, let's just begin in Psalm 14, verse 1. It says, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. They have all turned aside. They have together become corrupt. And there is none who does good, no, not one. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call on the Lord? There they are in great fear, for God is with the generation of the righteous." So all of those tell us something about the fool who says there is no God, or it lives as if there is no God. And so it's a good place for us to begin in evaluating the subject of a fool. As you look at this, we have to ask the question, can we as Christians be fools? Can we as Christians be fools? And in fact, we can be, as we'll see. And as a minister, over the years, I've learned that it's possible for Christians to be foolish, and because of different actions or sometimes inaction. And we might well say, well, since my conversion, as we look at ourselves, we might say, I've never said there is no God, so there's no way that I could be a fool. And we may have never said those words, but as you look at this, you may be surprised what we can surmise what from what David has to say. So we might ask, how could this happen? A fool is Nabal, and as I said, that is the name of the man that's married to Abigail in the story where David asked for some food, and after his troops had protected Abigail and Nabal and all of that, well, Nabal wasn't going to give them anything. And so that just infuriated David, and David thankfully did not take action, but he sure felt like it. And eventually Nabal just keeled over, sadly, from a heart attack. But as you look at a person who is a fool, there's some interesting things that may be happening in the fool's life, and it may be surprising. As you look at a fool, it's not, he's not necessarily, does not believe in God. He may not be an atheist. He believes God exists, and it does not even mean that such a person does not see God in his creation, that he believes God is the creator. And the fool may believe that God is the creator, but the main thing is, God is not involved in his life. He may believe all of those things about God, and he may respect God on a certain level, but he does not take action to honor God and pray to God and do those things that are important to a relationship with God. This person that's a fool, though not an atheist, lives as if he believes no God exists. And so you may say, well, if he believes in God, how can he live as though God doesn't exist? Well, that can happen as a result of him really not heeding God, not listening to God, not doing those things that build a relationship with God. Even though he knows God exists, he does not have any relationship with him. And a person who is a fool and yet may not be an atheist, he acts as if God does not exist. He reasons wrongly. A note in Nabal is a person who chooses or assumes to ignore the fact that God has authority in his life. So God, he just operates at arm's length from God, does what he wants to do, and yes, God's there, but God's not going to take any action against me. He basically sees God as an absentee landlord who may be safely disregarded, because he assumes that God is really not active in his creation. And for us as God's people to come to that conclusion is really foolishness, because God is very active in his creation. And to conclude that he isn't and to act as if he is not is really treading on thin ice. In the biblical context, foolishness can be sin. The fool's problem is not with his brain, but his heart. He's capable of grasping the things of God, but he possesses no real fear or reverence for God and the things of God. In a sense, you might call it practical atheism. A practical atheism. And even though he may readily admit that God is creator, he lives his life as if there is no God, that God doesn't exist. He's nowhere around. And he's produced a striking contrast between what he intellectually knows. He acknowledges that there is a God, but he doesn't act in a way that is backs up that belief. Simply put, the way one is living does not follow what one believes if you are a practical atheist. So God says that such a person is a fool, and he is in reality saying in his heart, there is no God, and he lives as if God did not exist. He may intellectually acknowledge that, but he lives as if God does not exist. And we have to be, that's why we have to be careful as Christians, because we can believe that God exists and then live in such a way that denies that. So we can say there is a God, but you know, I'm not going to tithe. I'm not going to go to the feast, and I'm not going to do these things because I don't believe they need to be done. And God is not going to take action anyway. And you know, that's, and God expects us to be doers of the word. So if we believe in God, then we have to take action and put into action those things that God does teach us. Psalm 14, verse 5. Psalm 14, verse 5 implies that these people who are fools are in great fear. It says they are in great fear, for God is with the generation of the righteous. So what's happening here, where this individual that says there is no God is in fear? He's aware of God, but when the punishment or the curse or sin comes, when God begins to reveal himself as the judge of sinners and the fool because of what he knows of God, also knows great fear. So he's not lived a life that backs up his belief in God. He's lived a life that in fact denies God. And so when the time for judgment comes, he realizes, I've not done what I should, and he's in fear of the punishment to come. And if he truly thought that there is no God, then what's he have to fear? There is no God. God's not going to punish him. But in fact, as he looks at the reality, he does believe in God enough to know that God is going to judge him and punish him. But then you wonder, well, why didn't you take action? Why didn't you take action to live God's way of life? You look at the individual who is in the parable of the minas and the parable of the talents. He has been given a talent, been given a mina, but does nothing with it. So he knows that God has given him this, but he does nothing with it. But there does come a time of judgment, and that's something that we have to realize. So if we ignore God and we just go about our business and hope that things are going to get better, or we're somehow going to survive this, we have to always keep in mind that it's doubtful we'll survive if we do not yield to God. So for a fundamental thing is that as we talked about when we were talking about wisdom, is we have to believe that God exists, and that from God all wisdom flows. And it is through our relationship with God that we can gain wisdom and put it into effect in our lives and avoid the foolish path, which is a most destructive path. So as you think about the most fundamental thing about a person that is a fool, is that they don't believe that God exists and they don't operate as if he exists. So for us to be the beginning point of wisdom is what? It is the fear of God. And the person who follows the foolish path doesn't fear God until it's judgment time. And then, maybe I should have honored God when I had the chance. Now let's think about another aspect of the fool. And as Christians, we all run into fools, and we have to interact with those people who are foolish from time to time. And so let's go to Proverbs chapter 26 and look at verses 4 and 5, because they're probably two standout verses that we had to sort out and come to an understanding of in order that we could answer the fool. And they seem to be contradictory, but as we understand them, they're not. Basically, they're giving us two sides of the same coin. So verse 4 says, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him." And verse 5 says, "Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes." So the question is, when do we answer a fool? Or when do we reject answering a fool? And as you look at these, there seems to be a contradiction, but there really is not. It's really not a contradiction, but a dilemma, an indication that when it comes to answering fools, there's no winning. It doesn't matter whether you answer them or you don't answer them, you're not going to win. So you just realize I'm dealing with somebody who's foolish here, and you have to make a judgment. Is it better to answer them or not to answer them? So it's unwise to argue with a fool at his own level and recognize his own foolish suppositions. But sometimes it's also good to refute the fool soundly, lest his foolishness seem to be confirmed by our silence. So sometimes it's wise to answer, sometimes it's not wise to answer. You have to evaluate this. This is where wisdom comes in, where you apply wisdom. What's the right thing to do here? Should I answer or should I keep my mouth shut? What is the best action to take here? And you need God's wisdom in order to discern what is the best path to go. In a book called The Alleged Contradictions in the Bible, a fellow by the name of B.J. Clark points out that the close proximity of these two verses seems odd in the sense that they're diametric opposites. But and that is an indication that this isn't a contradiction, but this was a deliberate decision that God inspired to put them both together. So they're right there together as opposites and give us an indication that there are two ways we can look at this in order to rightly understand it. It's not God didn't make a mistake by putting them both together. Another fellow by the name of James Jackson in his article Answering the Fool suggests that such a close proximity is by design or order. It's something that God intended in order that we could learn from it. E.W. Bullinger, who's written extensively about the Bible, suggests that the connection between these two verses can be found and explained by an ellipsis. And I know everybody knows what an ellipsis is. Most of us don't. I don't unless I look it up. But I looked it up, and an ellipsis is something deliberately left out to grab the reader's attention. As we think about that ellipsis, we are told in Proverbs chapter 26, verse 3, something that we have to keep in mind. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 3, it says, "A whip for the horse, a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the fool's back." You know, why do you need a whip for the horse? You need a whip for the horse in order to stimulate it to go. And you need a bridle for the donkey because sometimes the donkey goes and sometimes it doesn't, and donkeys have been known to be pretty stubborn. And rather than considering these proverbs as absolute commands, the reader finds cause and effect conditions. If we answer a fool, you'll be like him if you're not careful. And if we don't answer a fool, he will assume that certain things about us. So we have to be careful. Either way, as we answer, we would lose. But as you look at the donkey can be pretty stubborn, and a fool is most definitely that kind of a person. He's stubborn, just like the donkey is stubborn. And what he's doing there is comparing reasoning with a fool to reasoning with a donkey. So if we've tried that, most of us have not been successful in when the donkey digs in its feet and I'm not going to move, trying to persuade that donkey to move is pretty tough to do. So it's hard to get that donkey to move. So as you look at this, these two verses, then another writer notes that it's a paradox. It's an instance of a paradox is the conundrum or riddle. And the writer says, no matter what you do, maintains this fellow who wrote Answer Not a Fool or Answer a Fool, says a conundrum focusing more on readiness to answer rather than on answering. So you have to look at, should I answer or shouldn't I? And that's where wisdom comes in. So you want to learn to make right choices, and we all do run into the individual who is a fool, and it would be better that we didn't answer sometimes, and sometimes we want to be able to answer. One writer said in a thing called 12 Rules for Bible Study, looks at the two verses there and says that the two verses aren't contradictory, but they are complementary. And the use of either verse, that is, its principle applied to a particular use, depends on the set of circumstances. So you got to look at the situation and make a decision on whether you answer. And both of these verses contain gems of wisdom that each one of us needs to learn to properly answer, apply in answering other people's questions. So if people ask you questions, sometimes you have to think about, I don't think this person really wants to know. And then there are other people who legitimately want to know. So you have to look at the situation and make a decision on how you will answer. So we, as people who are learning wisdom, we need God's help in order to answer the questions in the most appropriate way possible. I think if you look at some of the news conferences that take place, presidential news conferences, not only with the current president, but other presidents, you've got the press that is constantly seeking to get whoever the press secretary is. And they want to score points. And sometimes their question is legitimate, but sometimes it's not. So you have to have the wisdom. Should I answer this question? And then answer it wisely. And so trying to answer questions is something that's very challenging, especially when you don't exactly know where somebody's coming from. Now let's go to Proverbs chapter 26, verse 18. So we're moving on from the two verses that seem to be contradictory there in Proverbs chapter 26. And this is interesting because as you think about what it's talking about here, it looks like here it says a madman, and it speaks of that madman throwing firebrands, arrows, and death. So is that speaking literally? A madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death. And then it says in verse 19, is the man, this guy who throws these firebrands, arrows, and death, is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I was only joking. So if you were dealing with this individual who's throwing firebrands in order to catch you on fire, or arrows to spit you with, and death, would you say, would you believe that he was only kidding in the way that he approached you? All of these are serious things that he's sending your way. And he's saying, oh, I didn't mean it. Hey, it was just a joke. But we've all been in circumstances where somebody does something to us that it hurts us physically or mentally, and yet they say, hey, I was just joking. But usually when we go through that experience, we think, you say you were joking, but what you've done is caused injury. And God calls such a person a fool. You know, to be joking and doing things that are dangerous and hurtful is foolishness. It is foolishness. A person who does such things is as a crazy person who randomly shoots arrows into a crowd. You know, if you ran into somebody who is shooting arrows in the crowd and you happen to be in that crowd, then are you going to believe they were joking, especially if they make contact with somebody? You know, you look at, it would be like the fellow that was involved in the mass shooting in Las Vegas. He was shooting from a hotel. And if he were to say after it was all over, well, I was just joking, how many of us would accept that particular point of view, that he was just joking? I mean, you have people that were murdered in that situation and people that were seriously injured. and we're going to accept that he was joking. We would tend to say that I think that you did mean what you did and judge him accordingly. So doing those kinds of things that are injurious, you can see that God uses an extreme example here in order to make his point. And for us to act in a way that injures somebody else, even in a small way, we need to consider whether that's wise. Or should we maybe keeping our mouth shut or doing only those things that are going to edify and build up and don't do things that injure others. And so that God considers that foolishness, and it's something that we should avoid as people who are learning to be wise. Now let's go to Amos chapter 8. We're going to look at a few verses here and a few related verses. Amos chapter 8, beginning in verse 11, it's a prophetic passage. Amos chapter 8, verse 11 says, "Behold, the days are coming." And the days aren't here yet, but they are coming. And what is described here in the words of the prophet Amos we're getting ever closer to them. "Behold, the days are coming that I will send a famine on the land, not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but hearing the words of the Lord." So there is coming a famine. There is coming a famine on the land, and it is going to be quite serious because of the implications of what God is saying here. Verse 13, "In that day the fair virgins and strong young men shall faint for thirst. Those who swear by the sin of Samaria, who say, 'As your God lives, O Dan,' and 'As the way of Beersheba lives,' they shall fall and never rise again." The New Testament, and so what's this talking about as you look at these verses here? A corollary verse to what is said here, and we will talk about this further, is found in Romans chapter 1, verses 28 through 32. And there the apostle Paul talks about some people who did not believe in God and did not act as if God exists. In Romans 1, verses 18 through 32, it tells us of unrighteous men who suppress the truth. They suppress the truth, as it says in the scriptures. They know that God exists, and they've rejected the God that exists, as it tells us there in Romans chapter 1. And it says they weren't thankful for what the creation reveals of the Creator. Their foolish hearts became darkened, and they lose what light, what truth they have. So those, the people mentioned in Romans 1, they had been enlightened, but they rejected it. They rejected it and turned towards suppressing the truth. They lose what light, what truth they have. And God's response is similar to his response to Israel in the book of Amos. He does not contend with them or force his truth on them. He didn't in ancient Israel, and he's not going to do it with people in our time. Instead, Paul writes, God gave them up to uncleanness. That's what God is going to do here as prophecy plays out, and it played out in ancient Israel. He gave them up to vile passions, which it talks about in Romans 1, verse 26. And then in verse 28, it says he gave them over to a debased mind. And I felt that this trend has been unfolding before our very eyes as we look at what's going on in our own country. And you look at some of the decisions that we're making and some of the decisions that are being made by the Supreme Court and our governing bodies and governing and our leaders, they don't seem like wise decisions. They seem like foolish decisions. And some of them seem rather debased. You know, the different things that are going on with abortion on demand, and some of the grisly things that go on there. It is as if God gives us exactly what we're seeking. And that seems to be what he's doing here with our country. And they do not realize that getting everything we want, God's allowing it, But it's a curse, and as time unfolds, that curse is going to become more apparent. A second example of this foolishness is found in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 9 through 12, where it talks about a future man of sin. That man of sin draws ever closer. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 9 through 10. And this man of sin is going to come on the scene, and that this man of sin is going to impact the world and deceive the spiritually weak. As it says, the coming of the law of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders. So Satan's going to be hard at work in our world, and he's going to impress the world and influence the world with all power, signs, and not just wonders, but lying wonders, wonders that are given in order to deceive. Verse 10, and with all unrighteousness, deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And this gives us a hint as we think about this verse of what wisdom is. Wisdom is to seek the truth, and to receive it, to receive the love of the truth, to seek it and live by it. Because it is through the truth that we might be saved. So we want to love the truth, because somebody is going to try to influence it. The truth is not the truth. And to get us to turn from the truth. And if we do turn from the truth, what's going to happen? It says in verse 11, and for this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So that they've taken more pleasure in unrighteousness than living, understanding, and living by the truth. The coming of the lawless one is going to greatly impact our world. It's not here yet, but as you look at the what's taken place with the riots and the looting and all the burning and all of that, and the setting up of a separate country within the bounds of our nation, you're looking at something that the Bible predicted. It says lawlessness will abound. And it says the love of many will wax cold. And you're seeing with what's taking place in our country, you're seeing this unfold right before our eyes in various ways. And it's rather disillusioning to see all of it. And I think there was a time, most of the time that I've been alive, I've always felt that there was hope, that there are bad things going on. But it seems at this time, since the coronavirus and all of the things that have come, one right on the heels of the other, it's rather saddening. And you can see, will it change? That's going to be up to God. But it seems like things are happening very rapidly, which we need to all pay attention to and think about, wow, this is going rather quickly. Where am I at? Do I have all the wisdom that I need? Am I ready to take on the man of sin and to not be taken in by the lying wonders and the teaching and all of that? We have to examine ourselves and think about that, because Satan is going to give you his best shot and seek to deceive you and me and the whole world around us. But if we have the love of the truth, then God will see us through. The love of the truth is a crucial thing in our lives. I remember back to when we were being taught about the Trinity and being influenced to accept that particular idea. And it took me a while to see through it. But I did love the truth. I did love the truth. And I think that God had mercy on me in the fact that I did love the truth and I wanted to understand the truth and live by the truth. And God in his mercy helped me to get things clear in my mind so that I could rightly deal with what was coming my way. So as you look at Romans chapter 1, you have the unrighteous worldview that's being portrayed there, and a worldview without a creator, so they can be liberated. And do you think that it, you know, you think about the people that have set up in the new nation within the United States, they have declared themselves free. We're liberated. Do you think that they are? Do you think that they are? I was looking at something today, and with some of the things going on in there, I don't believe it's the summer of love taking place there. So people may tell you that, but I don't think that's what's unfolding. Let's go to Amos 8, verse 12, and we'll pick up in Amos once again. Amos chapter 8, verse 12. It says, "They shall wander from sea to sea, and from north to east. They shall run to and fro, seeking the word of the Lord, but shall not find it." There's going to come a point in time where people are going to say, you know what? There's got to be a better answer than all of the craziness going on around me. And they're going to look for the answers that they need. They are going to look to the word of God. They're going to wander from sea to sea. It would seem to indicate going back and forth between the Mediterranean and the Sea of Galilee, that they're going to wander between those two bodies of water looking, or maybe the Dead Sea. They're going between those two bodies of water trying to get the answers that they're looking for. And it talks about they will also go from north to east, but it's interesting, they're going in these different directions seeking truth, seeking understanding, and they're going in directions that are never going to bring that about. And it's interesting that as you look at what Amos says, it never mentions them going south. Why wouldn't they go south? Because south is where God dwells, in the temple in Jerusalem. They're not going to go south to the temple in Jerusalem, because they're looking elsewhere. They're not looking to God for the answers that they need. They're going to look everywhere but to God. And this was the circumstance in the time of Amos, where they were unwilling to go back to Judah and to worship there. They set up their, followed Jeroboam as he set up his own gods. And they did not follow the true God. And so it's sad as you look at them wandering and they can't find the answers that they so much need. So you can see prophetically, you're going to have things work out where people are looking for the truth, or they're looking for the wisdom of God and they can't find it. And they're going to look everywhere but where it can be found, and that is from God in heaven. There is no temple in Jerusalem, so there's no reason to go south, but to go up to God's heavenly throne and speak to God is where you're going to find wisdom. That's where we're going to find wisdom. And that's why we need to stay tuned in to our God. Let's go to the parable of the rich man. And this is another way that we can go off and wander off into a foolish path. And so let's look at the parable of the rich man in Luke chapter 12, verse 16. Luke chapter 12, verse 16. It says, "Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully." So this person made a lot brought in a lot of crops, made a lot of money, and was quite successful. And so he abounded in his abundance. "Look at all the stuff I have. Look at all the crops I'm bringing in." And he thought within himself, saying, "What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops? I mean, I've got crops to overflowing. What do I do with all this?" So he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. This person had it made. He had everything that he could want and more. And the road ahead only seemed prosperous. I mean, he expanded his barns. He filled his barns up. And he's he's about as successful as he possibly could be. And so he, and so it says in verse 19, so he's building these barns and he has many goods laid up. Verse 20, but God said to him, fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. I mean, the fool is not worried about whether he's rich toward God. So he's worried about, you know, he may even be a practical atheist in the sense that yeah, I know God exists. Yes, I go up to the holy days and I do all those things. But, you know, I'm not being really changed and motivated by the things that I'm learning from God. And the person is in a state where they're not rich toward God when their life comes to an end. And we all have to ask ourselves, you know, are we pursuing money or are we pursuing a job or power or whatever it may be? And as we pursue all those things, is God still in there where he should be, first and foremost? Or is our personal selfish pursuits, is that the most important thing that is going on in our lives? The sudden cutting short of the rich man's career expresses not only the folly of assuming one knows what the future holds, but also of staking one's whole life on what may disappear at a moment. I know I have to admit that back in February, the stock market reached a high point. And as I looked at my portfolio, I thought, wow, it's doing pretty good. But you know what? A month later, it wasn't doing so good. And I think many of us could say the same thing. So just because we think everything is going well doesn't mean it will continue to do so, especially when it comes to things like money and power and position and all of those kinds of things. Things can change very quickly. You know, you have a tornado, you have the hurricane, and flooding takes place. All kinds of things that can happen and happen suddenly and cause your circumstance to change. But if we, no matter what our circumstance is, if we proceeded in a wise path, then we're going to have a relationship with God. We're going to have a relationship with God, and then no matter what happens, it may be unpleasant. It may be hard. So let's look at Luke chapter 24. Luke chapter 24, he's walking along the road, and he's talking to these two men, and he's talking about, and so they're talking about Jesus Christ, and he seems to be unknowing about what's taking place. So he asked them about it. And then finally, they get to a point where he reveals himself in chapter 24, verse 25. It says, then he said to them, O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken, ought not the Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? So it was only appropriate that Christ would go through all of this in order to save mankind from their sins. It had to take place in order that salvation could take place for mankind. And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So yes, he said, you guys are so slow, foolish, and slow of heart to believe. But what did Christ do? He said, I understand that. That's how human beings tend to be. And he began to expound to them the scriptures that emphasize that he was the Christ. And that's what Christ does for you and me. He's patient with us and continues to work with us in order to help us learn and understand and come to a better understanding of the scriptures. And sometimes we may be slow of heart. We may be foolish because we don't know everything we need to know. But God's very patient with us, and God's going to work with us and help us to develop an understanding of God and his way of life. Well, let's go to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. Galatians chapter 3, verse 1. And Christ, Paul addresses the Galatians in chapter 3, verse 1. And he says to them, "O foolish Galatians, O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed among you as crucified?" So Christ, in establishing the church in Galatia, had clearly laid out the sacrifice of Christ and its importance to a relationship with God, its importance to salvation. He had laid it out. And these people had been baptized and made a commitment to follow that path that stemmed from Christ's sacrifice. And he says to them, "Who has bewitched you? Who's gotten you off track? What's happened?" You know, it's like somebody has cast a magic spell over you. And what's happened is this spell that's been cast over him has seemingly caused them to not obey the truth. So they had been influenced, and they had turned from the truth. And Paul is just amazed. And he said, so Paul had done his best to try to teach them and convict them of what was right and true from the scriptures. And as you look at the word foolish here, they just had lost sight of the truth. The implication of what's taking place here is interesting when considered in light of what the letter to the Galatians is fundamentally about. The Galatians were trying to use the rites and ceremonies and physical requirements of Gnostic Judaism to work their way into God's kingdom. So they were trying to follow a humanly devised path in order to receive salvation, to be a part of God's kingdom. And Paul's already told them that doesn't work. That did not work for the Jews, and it's not going to work for you. And that's why he calls them foolish Galatians. Their emphasis was on what they were doing rather than God working in them, which required their yielding to God and their seeking God in order that God could accomplish his work in them. Their focus was on things dealing with the senses, things that we would be by definition sensual. And that's not sexual. That's a matter of just going with your senses. Going with your physical senses and follow them in reasoning and in sorting things out. And Paul said, this is a dead end. Don't rely on your senses, rely on God. So they were foolish. They were foolish in that they were not rightly judging, they were not rightly figuring things out and going in the right direction. So he said, Paul is, the Galatians were not exercising their minds. They were unobservant, uncomprehending, unheeding. And they were not thinking things all the way through and not fully considering all the aspects of the direction they were headed, which was away from God, not toward eternal life, but losing an understanding of the basic truths that the Apostle Paul had taught them. Paul here is continuing with a theme from Galatians 1, verses 4 through 9, namely that the Galatians were falling away. He calls it so soon removed from the original teaching that had been given to them by God through his human servants. They were abandoning the right foundation. They were abandoning the truth, leaving it behind. And Paul says, don't go down that path. Listen to what I taught you and stick with that. So he sees them as being bewitched. Like I said, it's like somebody cast a spell over them and they had just completely lost it. And And in my time in the church, I've seen this happen. I've seen individuals who were adamantly for the truths that had been taught in the past about God's law, about righteousness, about forgiveness of sins, about Jesus Christ, and about God's way of life. And then all of a sudden, these people who were on that page all just said, it all fell into place, and they all went in a completely different direction. And it was a most sad outcome because a lot of people that I knew and respected went in that direction. And so you can see that if we're not careful, we can be hoodwinked into following a path that is not leading to eternal life, but to death in the lake of fire. Let's just look. We are at.
It's 7:59.
7:59?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're at 7:59. So believe it or not, we're going to stop at this point.
Is that a good place to stop?
It is a good place to stop because we're going to switch to talk about a few other things that dealt with the fool, but some other things that I think are beneficial. So it was. I would go with that because it gives you a contrast to what we're talking about in regard to wisdom. And wisdom is something that we all need to grow in, and we're going to need it in the years ahead. Because there's a greater chance now of our being confronted about our beliefs than in my entire life in the church. It's coming. And people are going to ask you if you agree with certain ideas. And if you say, I don't agree with that because it's not biblical, just consider the latest decision by the Supreme Court. You have no leg to stand on as a Christian any longer because of that decision. So what's going to happen is that decision is going to flesh out and it's going to expand. And it's going to eliminate our religious freedom. It's going to deeply impact it. Because if you tell somebody that you believe a certain way based upon the Bible, you have to realize that the Bible is considered at this time a hate book. It is preaching hate and bigotry and discrimination. We've always felt that we have certain religious rights and liberties. And as one congressman said the other day, he said that all that is, religious liberty and all of that and religious rights, it's all code word for discrimination and prejudice. That's the conclusion. And he's not in the minority. He's becoming a part of the majority. Our world has truly been transformed. And I hope it'll turn back. But if it continues on this path, then we're going to be confronted by what we believe, and we're going to need wisdom to answer those questions. And just as Christ told his disciples, you'll be taken before the councils, you'll be asked questions, you'll be put on the spot, and if you don't answer correctly, then you'll suffer the consequences. And we're in a stage where, it's kind of like the French Revolution. In the French Revolution, if you did not buy into what was happening in France and you happened to fall under the gaze of the leadership of the French Revolution, then you were hauled before the tribunal and you had to answer. And if they didn't like what you were saying, then you would be guillotined. So it's serious times that we live in. Christ said these times would come, and we need God's wisdom to sort through it. And God will be with us and he'll give us the words that we need so we can go forward in faith and continue to study and continue to pray and to have a relationship with God. So I thank everybody for tuning into the Bible study this week. We'll have another Bible study next Wednesday, the 24th. And I'm going to continue talking about the fool, and we'll finish with that. And there are characteristics of those people who are foolish, and we'll just look at them in review. And you might also think about individuals that you would classify as maybe foolish or fools, either in the Bible or in the society around us. It is interesting that sometimes the people that are most admired happen to be quite foolish when you really look at what they say and what they do. They may be talented, but they fall short when it comes to wisdom. So we'll go ahead and end the Bible study.